This is AMDA On The Go, your gateway to expert discussions, journal article reviews, and innovation in post-acute and long-term care. AMDA On The Go is a presentation of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this broadcast is provided by the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now here's our host for AMDA On The Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to AMDA On The Go. Today's episode focuses on frailty. Over 15 years ago, Dr. Linda Fried and others defined frailty as a multidimensional syndrome based on loss of reserves, a patient phenotype that could anticipate disability with the criteria of unintentional weight loss, exhaustion, weakness, slow walking speed, and low physical activity. This definition resonated in discussions about elder patients' examinations and outcome potentials, served as a reference for research studies, and was utilized as a solution to board examination-related questions. Around the same time as Dr. Fried, Dr. Kenneth Rockwood, Dr. Arnold Mitnitsky, and others, using information gathered from the Canadian Study of Health and Aging, approached frailty in ways other than identifying a specific frailty definition. They considered a frailty index by accounting for aging patients' clinical deficits based on 70 different items in geriatric syndromes accumulated over time, and they presented a clinical frailty scale based on a provider's clinical judgment alone. Both were deemed effective measures, and the clinical frailty scale correlated with a 5-year prediction of death or entry into long-term care. Research in frailty over the years has shown correlations with hormonal changes, changes in protein metabolism, apoptosis, and altered gene expression, as well as sarcopenia. Today, one could read the Journal of Frailty and Aging and attend the yearly International Conference on Frailty and Sarcopenia. In the April 2018 issue of JAMDA, the Journal of the American Medical Director Association, Dr. Philip Sloan, the JAMDA co-editor-in-chief, and Dr. Matteo Cesari, a leader in frailty, in their editorial, Research on Frailty, Continued Progress, Continued Challenges, review 6 original research studies on frailty and comment on the thorny issues that still surround the syndrome. Dr. Sloan is with us now. Dr. Philip Sloan is a family physician and geriatrician with a master's degree in public health. He is the Elizabeth and Oscar Goodwin Distinguished Professor of Family Medicine and Geriatrics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and the co-director for the Program on Aging, Disability, and Long-Term Care at the Cecil G. Shepps Center for Health Services Research. Dr. Sloan, welcome to AMDA On The Go.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you today.
Dr. Sloan, in your editorial, you reflect on the ambiguity residing behind the use of frailty as an adjective and or a visual distinction and question the significance of the term pre-frailty. After 20 years of definitions, research, and studies, why is there still ambiguity around frailty? Why is frailty still such a complex topic? And if we haven't a clear understanding of frailty now, how can we make sense of pre-frailty?
Well, that's a difficult question. It will take a little bit of discussion to elucidate. But you know, in a scientific sense, it's not surprising that we're still struggling with this. I mean, we're struggling with defining quality of life. We're struggling with defining cognitive impairment and many of the kind of big issues that we deal with in care of older persons. What happened, I think, was the field adapted a word that had been used in the general public for a long time. Now, if you ask the average person on the street, you know, what frail means, they're going to have an idea, and it has nothing to do with our definition. It's more like, you know, old and skinny, or possibly more likely to fall or die, or might need to go to a nursing home, this kind of thing. So in the scientific realm, the term was initially used to try to quantify the fact that most impairments of older persons are multifactorial. And what we see is the cumulative effect of reduced functional reserve. And so, as you said, Linda Fried came up with a specific, what she called a phenotype, which is really about weight loss, fatigue, and a number of musculoskeletal parameters. So it's almost, it's focused more on musculoskeletal loss. And because of that, scientists have then moved on to explore actual loss of muscle mass, which is what we call sarcopenia. But the other concept, which is also out there, is more about frailty as anything that happens that's bad as you get older. The Rockwood approach, I call it the kitchen sink approach. Because essentially, they took 70 items, IADLs, ADLs, musculoskeletal function, medical conditions, sleep changes, psychological status, symptoms, medical diagnoses, and they made this big, long list. It's great for epidemiology. It's great for prognosis on a population basis, but it's not really helpful clinically because clinicians are always trying to figure out what can we do something for? You know, what's something that we can change? And if you've got a list of 70 things, you've got to go down to the individual things to decide what to do. So from these general ends of the spectrum, there are a bunch of other tools that kind of are placed somewhere along the spectrum between real specific, which is the kind of Freed idea, and the real general, which is a Rockwood idea.
What can you tell us about the concept of pre-frailty?
Well, as you can imagine, there's no good way to make a cutoff between frail and not frail. And so as soon as that happens, you got a group of people who don't quite meet either definition, but there's some desire to identify people who meet part of the definition. That's what pre-frail is. And the best way I can exemplify it, and Dr. Cesari really thinks we're having enough trouble defining frailty. Let's not spend a lot of time trying to elucidate clearly what pre-frailty is. But anyway, here are examples. Now, two types of pre-frailty. One of them is an 88-year-old grandmother who lives alone. Now, she does her own housework. She has a small garden. She tends the garden using a stool. She takes out her own garbage in small bags. Her daughter shops for her because she doesn't drive. Her son takes out the dog for long walks once a week because she walks it a block or two. She hasn't fallen, but is careful. Her family worries about her. And she's lucky to have some mild cognitive impairment. So this is kind of like a skinny old pre-frail person. Okay. A very different type of person also would be classified as pre-frail. This, as an example, would be a 68-year-old obese grandmother who drives, is cognitively intact, keeps her house, but walks very little, has a walker she rarely uses a motorized grocery cart when she shops, and has a family do manual household chores such as taking out the garbage. So they both partly meet the frailty definition, but they're really quite different in their function, and most studies suggest that their prognoses are going to be different too. And these are just two of many different ways that kind of pre-frailty can manifest itself.
So it's complex, and it just shows for those of us who are geriatricians that elders truly are like snowflakes. No two are alike, and perhaps the concept of pre-frailty that you describe really does show the heterogeneity that is inherent in elders in geriatric medicine.
It's so true, and when you think about instruments, like instruments to measure frailty or any of the tools that are out there in the literature, it's a real challenge to find one that applies in the clinical setting better than a physician just taking history and thinking. And frailty is not too bad. Some of the indices at least get us thinking differently. And I think that's been the big advantage of both frailty, sarcopenia, and some of those related, relatively newer ideas, that we're trying to deconstruct aging in a way that helps us identify interventions that we can actually do.
It would seem, or one might assume, from the work heralded by Freed and Rockwood, that the prevalence of frailty as a function of aging should be fairly constant regardless of other factors such as geography. But as you identify in your editorial, Libre Rodriguez and others, in a landmark study in JAMDA, reviewed urban and rural populations in Latin America, India, and China, and found variations in frailty prevalence. What accounted for such variation, and what does the variation mean for our understanding or definition of frailty?
Well, you know, that was a very interesting study, and they were quite ambitious. They had teams in each of seven countries that got populations, sampled them as well as they could. But there are a number of issues that, at least in my mind, explain why the differences are. Some of them have to do with the fact that different populations live differently. For example, studies have shown that physical activity and good physical health are both big protective factors against frailty. And conversely, lack of physical activity and chronic disease will predispose individuals to frailty. Now, we understand that different populations may have different prevalences of frailty just on the basis of that. You know, if you go to an area where the diet is very poor, or the lifestyle is poor, or the environment is bad, you can imagine that there'll be more chronic disease, maybe less physical activity. And then these, as predictors of frailty, will help have their impact on frailty. We know that some populations or subpopulations have more diabetes, heart disease, or arthritis, and some are more active in a healthy way, interested in fitness or walking more for transportation. Some are more active in unhealthy ways, such as assembly line workers or, for that matter, professional football players. The other thing that we have to keep in mind is none of these groups, like the group in India, did not randomly sample everybody in India. They went to one area in India, or they actually went to two areas, one in a city and one in a rural area, and they sampled from a relatively small group. So it's really not, you can't generalize a small group in India to India in its entirety, although at least it's a reasonable approximation to begin to initiate a conversation. Because none of these samples was a random sample of the entire country, we can't be really sure what they represent other than what they measured, you know, the population they measured. There's still some interesting stuff. For example, the differences between urban and rural frailty, there were some differences in India. In India, urban frailty was much higher than in China, but in China there was more pre-frailty. Now, is that a definitional issue? There are certainly differences in countries. Now, for example, we're getting a lot of, this is kind of off topic, but we're getting jammed a number of studies from Chinese writers and Chinese scientists about obesity. Well, their idea of obesity is you have a BMI of 25 to 30 and they're in the top 10 percentile of older Chinese. There are definite differences in the way people live from country to country.
And that was clearly a limitation that was identified, looking at the interpretation of frailty characteristics as a limitation in an international study. But what I thought was interesting was that in rural China, there were higher incidences of stroke, depression, dependence, but rural China's prevalence of frailty was 5.4%. In another article within this series that you've sponsored, the United States prevalence of frailty appears to be around 10%, but in Peru it was 20%, urban Peru. And so I guess the take home is that there really are more studies to be done, that one should not pick up and go to rural China and expect to be less frail from living there. There are other issues to review, but regardless, the variations appear to be real.
Mm-hmm. And whenever you see variation, it means that there's room for change.
A very interesting perspective.
Our interview will continue after this brief message from the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine, the only foundation dedicated to advancing the field and practice of post-acute and long-term care medicine. Our foundation is totally unique in focusing on issues of competence, quality, and the value we bring to patients in this setting. Please support the foundation at paltcfoundation.org.
We're talking with JAMDA co-editor-in-chief, Dr. Philip Sloan. Dr. Sloan, in the initial validation of the clinical frailty scale, higher scoring participants on the scale, more frail, were more likely to be cognitively impaired. The recent JAMDA article by Liu and others furthers the understanding of the connection between frailty and cognition, which I found to be very, very interesting. The idea of cognitive frailty. What did their study find, and are there consequences in outcomes due to the synergy of frailty and cognition.
Well, you know, I went through that article again to see exactly how they define cognitive frailty. And fortunately, they didn't, because I think, you know, you can identify anything as frail. You could add the word frail to anything that involves a deficit. But what they did look at more, at least in my reading of it, was the connection between cognitive decline or cognitive impairment and frailty. And in a way, the study confirmed what clinicians already know, which is that mm-hmm. as people develop dementia, they're much more likely to develop a propensity to accelerate the development of frailty as well. We understand latent cognitive impairment, latent Alzheimer's or other dementias, the pathways of neuromuscular function and control are affected by the disease. And that's why people are much more prone to fall, by they get, in some types of dementias, they'll get tremors or fasciculations, and they get weakness because it's a neurologic disease. Now, early in the disease, we don't see those kinds of neuromuscular impairments as much. But what we see is kind of a lack of initiative and kind of inability to plan ahead. So that's at least my explanation in my own head as to why cognitive impairment and frailty tend to parallel each other when you look at the two mm-hmm. together. If we think about the response to any kind of injury or any kind of illness to be dependent on one's physiological reserves, cognition is one of those physiological reserves that's really important.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, for example, you know, we know that, at least from one study that I'm really familiar with, the number one risk factor for failure to rehabilitate well after hip fracture is cognitive impairment.
Yes.
And it's a no-brainer why it is, but to us it is. But families may not understand that.
And families definitely cannot understand well without our support the interplay between the body and the brain. And this study helps us to understand how the two at least play with each other in the sandbox, so to speak. Dr. Sloan, as we're wrapping up this series, there are another two JAMDA articles on frailty, which appear to be related, at least with regard to the cardiac system. Allegra and others reviewed the relationship between frailty and prognosis in very elderly patients with acute coronary syndromes. But Tanasi and others looked at the relationship between the Mediterranean diet, a known means for reducing the risk of cardiovascular mortality, and frailty. Interestingly, the authors mentioned that frailty and pre-frailty are associated with an increase in inflammatory markers like interleukin-6 and C-reactive protein. Can we truly implicate dietary factors from the study in reducing the risk of frailty? Could this mean that investigations into other potential preventative medicine factors might also alter frailty development? And is this kind of where further understanding of pre-frailty really comes into play?
I think it does. My reading of the Allegri study, it's kind of interesting. It's what I call stealth geriatrics. It's the idea of trying to get geriatric principles into non-geriatric specialties. So these geriatricians went into 44 Spanish hospitals, got permission to go into cardiology service, did some very detailed investigations, and identified that frailty was a major prognostic factor for mortality after a cardiac event or cardiovascular event. Then they went back to the cardiologist and said, maybe you should be measuring frailty. What they basically did was give them a tool that makes them think a little more like a geriatrician. So I like that. And this other study, the Tanasi study, I have to say, leave it to the Greeks to study Mediterranean diet, right?
Absolutely.
So where did they find Greeks who weren't eating a Mediterranean diet? I couldn't quite figure that out, but they did go to two Greek cities and they had dietitians do a very detailed Mediterranean dietary score where they scored people's diet on some scale. So it was to the extent in which they were adhering to it, which is really a nice measure. Now, it was a cross-sectional study, so, you know, cross-section, you can't really identify anything but association. You can't really say that it causes. You can't talk about cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, diet tends to be something that tends to be reasonably permanent in a person's life, and so the association probably means more here. And indeed, they found a pretty strong association between this dietary score and frailty. And it's not surprising, once again, because cardiovascular disease, chronic disease, we know a Mediterranean diet will help prevent these things. To answer your original question, it gets around to the fact that with all this detailed stuff we're doing, and it's really important, the research we're doing, we are coming down with pretty simple guidance for how to reduce things like frailty. And it often gets down to eat well, exercise well, but not crazily. Use preventive measures and those basic other kind of preventive skills. It makes it difficult for a geriatrician because you wish that you could have gotten that message to people when they were 40.
If we can educate younger individuals, like you said, the 40-year-old, that really exercise and diet do actually play a vital role in reducing risks such as the onset of frailty, I think that could be a very powerful message. And it's a message that is coming from a geriatric journal, which I think is absolutely fantastic. Dr. Sloan, thank you so much for sharing your time with AMDA On The Go. We have been talking with Dr. Philip Sloan, the co-editor-in-chief of JAMDA, the Journal of the American Medical Directors Association. Dr. Sloan, thank you again.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
This podcast spotlights the April 2018 issue of JAMDA. Other references will be made available on the AMDA On The Go Podbean website. I'm your host, Dr. Wayne Saltzman. Thank you for sharing your time with AMDA On The Go.
Support for this broadcast is provided by the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM, pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, please email cmd@paltc.org with your name and the podcast title. Thank you.